Hello and a very warm welcome to the Studio Canal Presents podcast. My name is Simon Brew from Film Stories magazine, and this is a regular podcast celebrating one of the biggest and deepest film libraries in the world. Studio Canal's extensive library of over 6,000 films brings together cinema from around the globe. There are cast iron masterpieces such as Akira Kurosawa's Ran and Francis Ford Coppola's The Conversation, favourites such as Murder on the Orient Express and The Lady Killers, and some modern classics in there as well, such as Manchester by the Sea and Mulholland Drive. This episode, though, we're focusing on Mike Nichols' 1967 classic, The Graduate, which is heading to 4K Ultra HD Blu-ray for the first time. In a moment, I'm going to be joined by David Jenkins, the editor of Little White Lies magazine. Just before he joins me, though, here's a little taster of the film.
Ben, what are you doing?
Well, I would say that I'm just drifting here in the pool.
Why?
Well, it's very comfortable just to drift here.
Have you thought about graduate school?
No.
Would you mind telling me then what those 4 years of college were for? What was the point of all that hard work?
You got me.
A very big welcome to the Studio Canal Presents podcast then to David Jenkins. Hello, David. How are you?
I'm good, good. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure, and you've long been on our target list. So this is our moment.
Good to hear.
Now, whenever we bring a guest on, we just like to get a little film fact about them. You know, what was the first film you were watching? What got you into cinema in the first place?
Oh, good question. And you know what? You sprung this on me, and luckily I know it. Off the top of my head, it's not one of those that I'm sort of racking my brains to remember. There's actually two, I'm afraid. So
okay.
I'm already sort of going off script here a bit. But the one that I first remember is Who Framed Roger Rabbit and having the fear of God seeing Judge Doom.
How old were you?
I mean, that would have been about like 7 or 8. I mean, that was like 8. Was it 89 or 88? So that was pretty young. I mean, that was the year. I think that film's a 12A now. So and I don't think it was when it came out.
It should be an 18. That's right.
yeah. It's quite a disturbing film. And I'd remember feeling like, I mean, that was my first kind of like the cinema giving me that moment of fear.
Yeah.
But I remember the first film I absolutely loved was Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey.
The best one.
I really liked Bogus Journey. And I remember my dad took me to see it and he didn't like it. And we had an awkward conversation because I couldn't understand why he didn't like it.
There are certain risque jokes in Bogus Journey that a youngster doesn't get. I love Excellent
yes.
Adventure. Bogus Journey, yeah, I get it. I got taken to see Watership Down as a child. So, you know, I kind of see your Roger Rabbit and raise it a little bit.
Yeah,
there.
that's terrifying. I did watch that. That's a film I watched as a kid but have never revisited. And I'm waiting to revisit with my daughter maybe in like
50
20
years. Nobody revisits it for fun. Yeah. Nobody. David, we're here to talk about The Graduate, coming to 4K disc for the very first time. I mean, I appreciate many people listening will be familiar with it, but for those who aren't, can you just set the film up a little bit and why we're still talking about it nearly, what, 60 years on?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. It's become this canonical film, which I think one of the reasons why we're still talking about it is because it's quite a sort of generally beloved film that will show at festivals, at rep houses, and people will pick it up on Blu-ray, and you know it's got this kind of rewatch factor, and it's approachable. You know, there is an approachable element to it, but it's also a film that when you dig deeper, it has all these kind of, you know, darker resonances to it, which I'm sure we'll get into in a bit. But it's I think it's a tougher film than people remember it, and more of a one that's more a bit, you know, less sort of happy and fun as the kind of bright, colourful cinematography and the sort of plinky plonky Simon and Garfunkel score. Those might be the things that have lodged in our memory, but you know, the darkness prevails, as always.
It is a weird line that it draws, actually, for it to be such a, as it would turn out, spoilers for those coming to the end of the podcast, to be such a box office success as well, such a commercial and accessible success, as you said. Do you think the endurance is down to what is and was Under the Surface?
Well, I don't know. I was trying to think about this over the weekend, and, you know, it's a strange one, because when you read about it, there was so little going for it ahead of its release, in that, you know, I think people were kind of nervous about it. Nobody really wanted to make it. I mean, we'll get into all this, I'm sure, but, you know, there was trepidation about the casting, you know, all these things that, you know, would have been kind of red flags. Plus the fact that it didn't get great reviews. I mean, it was kind of modestly received, and there were quite mixed notices. But I wonder if it has got this thing where, you know, those kind of must see films where people are kind of talking, and it's like you know you have to see the ending of The Graduate. Can't tell you what it is, but you have to see it, because it's kind of, it does this thing that I haven't seen before, or it leaves you kind of wondering, and it puts you in this very uncomfortable position as a viewer, and doesn't give you a kind of rose-tinted happy ending, or actually it might do for some people who read it that way. But it's got the kind of choose-your-own-adventure ending, but that people would at that time would have needed to see to be able to be part of that conversation.
I mean, you used the phrase must-see film there. And in the case of The Graduate, which I think is a film, certainly I knew more of it before I watched it because of how it had soaked into culture, which I'll come to shortly. Does the advocacy hurt it, do you think? Do you think the fact that people talk about it as a great film puts people off? Or is this one of those instances where, like, it just delivers on it?
I don't know, to be honest. That's a tough one. I mean, it's sort of, I think it's a film that has maybe, like, I don't necessarily think it's a film that has been beloved since its release. And I think it is kind of, as with all
That's
films, they kind of ebb and flow in and out of the cultural conversation. And, you know, I think there are times when, you know, maybe in the sort of 90s and late noughts, it would have maybe been less of a thing, or, you know, but I guess with current conversations about, you know, quote unquote toxic masculinity, the film has suddenly kind of come round again, and has this kind of relevance once more, or is kind of plugging into a kind of wider cultural conversation once more, and can be used as this exemplar of the fact that it was, you know, politically kind of ahead of its time in terms of what it was talking about, and how it was presenting characters in a much more objective, critical, I mean, probably satirical way. I think it's always been there. And I think the other thing as well, which is interesting about it, is it's a real kind of cross-generational film in terms of those who like it. I mean, it's a film that I think, you know, the young people will get something out of Benjamin Braddock, played by Dustin Hoffman, having this, going on this very sort of steep learning curve. So I'm trying not to spoil it too much.
Do you know what? I was wondering how you were going to describe.
Yeah.
Steep learning curve. We'll go with that. Yeah.
His rite of passage. And then I think you know, maybe older viewers may be gravitating more towards Mrs. Robinson's story and trying to sort of see the things from her perspective. And I think it's a film that has like a kind of multiplicity of interpretations.
Going into the formation of The Graduate, can you touch on just some of the fragile touch points that made it so vulnerable, that made it such a weirdly tricky film to make?
Yeah. I mean, off the bat, you had Mike Nichols, and he had just, you know, he was the sort of wunderkind of Broadway.
Yeah.
He'd had all these hits. He was hot property. He had just directed Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, adaptation of the Edward Albee play. So we are with Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton, and Liz Taylor had apparently requested him as the director. So, you know, he was obviously kind of well known within the sort of Hollywood firmament. And this was the Graduate was the case of the difficult second movie. And there was this novella kind of going around Hollywood that was, you know, not entirely liked. It was The Graduate by Charles Webb. People were kind of passing it around and passing on it and found it too weird and too sardonic and too difficult and, you know, couldn't see the appeal of a kind of cross-generational romance that kind of, you know, went in much more sort of two-footed than maybe films had in the past. And it's kind of weird, and none of the studios would touch it, but Nichols really liked the novel. There was a sort of trepidation maybe about his liking for it, and yeah. And he was like maybe like not entirely certain of how you would play it, but
it was at one point going to be his first film.
Yeah,
had circumstances fallen a different way, had Elizabeth Taylor not lobbied for him so much for Virginia Woolf, there was a version of history that he would have got to it ahead of that. And what I found interesting about that is he stuck with it. You know, what you said about like him being drawn to the book that others were scared of. He had a chance to get out because he had the other film, but he still laser focused in on The Graduate straight after that.
Yeah. And you know what? I think you can kind of see why he did that.
Yeah.
And like, as well as him being a lauded director on Broadway, he was also a stage actor, and he did comedy recordings with Elaine May. You know, you listen to them and they are the most catty, sardonic, acerbic, hilarious like comedy shows of them just riffing. It's really funny. You listen to that and you can kind of you suddenly see so many of the characters in The Graduate almost being kind of workshopped for years ahead of their creation.
Oh,
maybe even before he'd read the novel. Especially like, you know, one of the sort of funny, probably that the most famously funny sequence in the film involves Benjamin's homecoming and the sort of cocktail party that his parents throw to him with all their friends who are similarly kind of nouveau riche, wealthy, aspirant, cultural, you know, quite like phonies basically.
Yeah.
and you know, the stuff that they're saying to him, the little kind of it's kind of this machine gun fire of hilarious little quips and quotable quips that you can kind of hear back in the old,
yeah,
Elaine May, Mike Nichols comedy recordings, because they're the kind of characters they would mock. You can see why he made this movie.
Hey, there's the award-winning scholar.
We're all very proud of you, Ben.
Thank you, Mrs. Carlson.
Is that the new car out there, that little red whop, Charlie?
That's Ben's graduation.
Well, you won't have much trouble picking up on that, will you?
Sir.
The girls, the chicks, the teeny boppers.
Oh, I think Ben's gotten beyond the teeny bopper stage, haven't you, Ben?
Yes, ma'am. Excuse me, honey, I'd just like to check something on the car for a minute.
Oh, his father bought him an Alfa Romeo. You know what
that is? Hey, here's the track star. How are you, track star?
That's fine, Mr. Loomis.
I want to get a drink. Then I want to hear all about that thing.
The story of how Dustin Hoffman landed The Graduate in itself is kind of one of those, almost like one of those Hollywood fluke stories. My favourite bit about it is I concluded that if he could sing really well, he would never have been in The Graduate. When he was auditioning for Mike Nichols in a musical on Broadway, The Apple Tree, and the role went to Alan Alda instead. I love little things like this. Role went to Alan Alda and the filming potentially would have crossed over because of that musical, but because Hoffman's voice wasn't quite good enough. But even then, Nichols had to fight for him.
Well, yeah, because he'd only been in one film, untested when it came to cinema, like big screen and outings. By all accounts, he wasn't even that interested in cinema. He saw it as a gamble, and being part of that world just wasn't financially feasible for him at that time, living in LA, trying to sort of go to auditions for movies. So having an advocate in Mike Nichols essentially was the best and only way in for him, really. I mean, reading about the audition process is really fascinating. I almost think you could make a film about the audition process to The Graduate, because it's like, it's got that non-traditional thing of like, you know, he goes in, by all accounts, a failure.
Yeah.
He's sort of flown in from New York. He hasn't really done any preparation. He doesn't know what he's doing. He doesn't want to be there. He's grumpy. He's a bit ill. And he has to do some scenes with his eventual co-star, Catherine Ross. And most people in the room were like, you did good, kid. Sigh. And then Nichols, like, saw in those screen tests the kind of awkward, nebbish,
yeah,
that he was looking for, you know, like it was that kind of like, I mean, Benjamin Braddock's key, one of his kind of most prominent traits is just not wanting to be in a room with other people. And in a sense, he gave, that's what exactly what he gave Mike Nichols.
But there were other options as well. So what, Hoffman wasn't effectively the first choice.
Yeah. I mean, there was a point where like Robert Redford and Candice Bergen were in the frame.
Imagine that.
Which would have made for a very different film. But you know what? Like, it's one of those things where we say it now in retrospect, like, oh, you know, you could never imagine Redford being this kind of awkward presence. But I remember that film. Do you ever remember that film, The Hot Rock, which is like the kind of
Seen that.
It's like a comedy heist film with him in, where it all goes wrong.
Yeah,
and it's got a sort of slapstick element to it, and he's definitely, you know, it's kind of mocking his kind of cool guy persona a bit.
Oh, interesting.
And you know, I thinking of that, I'm a bit like, yeah, maybe he could have. Maybe he could have done it. I mean, you know, I think it's maybe a bit disingenuous to say that he couldn't have done a, you know, all-in character turn. But I guess his legend,
yeah,
the image that he was building for himself at that time might not have been served very well by him being in The Graduate.
I mean, my favourite, most people's favourite piece of casting in The Graduate was the first piece of casting, I believe. Was it Anne Bancroft was the first on the call sheet, the first person to...
Yeah.
She's the pivotal piece of the jigsaw to me.
Yeah, yeah, no, she's obviously incredible in this film, and like, you know, the trivia that like people like to say is that, you know, although in the film they're meant to be, you know, the age gap's meant to be, it is much bigger than it is in reality, because Bancroft was only 8 years Hoffman's senior at that point. And you know, the effect of her age was created through makeup, costume design, a lot of, like, you know, Hollywood trickery.
Yeah.
But obviously she really sells it. And it's interesting, like, I think in modern cinema it's very noticeable when a big actress or actor who has maybe been in some big prestige films and been on the awards circuit and it's kind of built a reputation for themselves as being in a sort of safe family favorite, there will often be a point where they will take measures to kind of counter that a bit and say, no, I can be edgy. I can go into more edgy things. I've got range. And I mean, you see people now like, you know, Nicole Kidman's probably the best modern example of someone who's gone from, like, you know, the sort of pinnacle of Hollywood to being in quite a lot of, like, you know, weird Yorgos Lanthimos films and things like that. And I wonder if this was a sort of similar type of pivot, because you know, Bancroft was not known in her early career
for her
edginess. And she had won an Oscar, so she, you know, she was definitely part of big Hollywood at that time. So yeah, I think people would have been shocked by it. One, I mean, you know, obviously there's another huge long list of names that were kind of mentioned or in some apocryphal list of potentials. The one that I had to sort of stop and laugh at was that Doris Day was. was in the mix. And as one of the world's biggest Doris Day fans, I'm actually kind of glad she didn't do that, because for me, retaining her sweet image until the day she died, I'm fine with that. this would have been a weird one for Doris Day, I think.
May I ask you a question? What do you think of me?
What do you mean?
You've known me nearly all your life. You must have formed some opinion of me.
Well, I always thought that you were a very nice person.
Did you know I was an alcoholic?
Inevitably, can you touch on the music as well? I know this story is fairly well known.
I think the story goes that Nichols wanted to use The Sound of Silence.
Yeah.
I think as a little kind of discursive point here, but like, as a on a kind of artistic level, I personally find the use of music in the film really, really interesting.
Yeah.
Mainly the repetition, the way it kind of uses the same songs over and over again, and almost giving this sense of Mrs. Robinson's the doldrums of her life and this kind of this sense of boredom that she's in. And then obviously at the end you get "Here's to you, Mrs. Robinson." You might have to fill in some of the blanks here, but like from what I understand, it was Nichols wanted Paul Simon to write this song, and
yeah.
He was like, "Oh, I'm too busy," and then he said he had a song about Mrs. Roosevelt, and then Simon said, "No, just change it to Mrs. Robinson, and we're done. That's it. Cut, print. We've got it."
It's a lovely story.
And here's to you, Mrs. Robinson.
You talked about when the film wasn't revered from the off when it was completed, when it came out. But also what I was taken with was this story that it had to do the art house circuit, that it was treated almost in the same way that, let me delicately put this, a mildly risque film would have been, in that it went on fewer screens and in the end they had to do a campus tour just to try and promote the movie. Was there anything that particularly stuck out around the release of the film and the response to it?
I think that you read the review, the contemporary reviews of the day, and I think people came with it with a sense of trepidation. You know, it's one of those things where most films that are doing something quite radical and are not necessarily kind of spoon feeding you exactly what it is that their intentions are, do tend to be treated that way and tend to be revered later on after a time of reflection and discussion. And yeah, you read a lot of the reviews and I think it's that old chestnut which comes up quite a lot now. It's like, who is this for? Is it a film for youth? is it about innocence and trying to sort of find your way in the world? Or is it this kind of is it a film about Mrs. Robinson and sort of degradation and misogyny and the fact that she has kind of is it a film about the way she is represented in the film and the sort of, you know, this the doldrums of her life that she's currently in? And the thing about it that I think means that it's not going to get wouldn't have gotten the easiest critical ride is that it does have this, you know, its openness to it. There is an open it is an open text, and you can kind of read it any number of ways. I personally think that the film is a very melancholy film about Mrs. Robinson's character, and there are sort of intimations that, you know, I think that you watch her actions, which are in the moment are very a comic and they're very funny, and you see her kind of trying to sort of, you know, sink her claws into her young prey, which she does with relative ease. But then you have all these questions about, well, why is she doing this? Like, she's in a family, she is affluent, she has all this stuff, but, you know, it kind of is tapping into this really late 60s sense of ennui, of boredom, of, you know, you had films like Zabriskie Point, which were about blowing up the kind of polite plastic society, and The Graduate was kind of doing it as well, like in that it was a real criticism of, like, well, look at the world that has made this woman and the things she is doing. And, you know, you're also asking, well, why is she so mad that Benjamin is also sort of being drawn towards her daughter, which is the real kind of, for me, the real radical question in the film of, like, what is it that is spurring her reaction? Is it jealousy? Like, is she jealous of her young daughter and having this opportunity, or is she sickened by the fact that her daughter might be drawn towards this guy who is obviously so easily led and so obviously amoral, and, you know, will clearly, you know, do the things to her that she has had done to by her husband. So yeah, it's a film that, you know, on a first pass, I can't imagine many people really getting to full grips with. I mean, I know that's disingenuous, and you know, I'm sure Pauline Kael had her take.
I was always taken with a later Mike Nichols film. It's not talked about much, Working Girl. and not spoiling endings, I would just say that the ending of Working Girl was supposed to be melancholic, but people saw it as really upbeat. I thought that was really interesting. I think running right through Nichols's films, there's a bunch of final acts that can just be taken in perhaps not necessarily the way that Mike Nichols might have intended.
Or maybe he did. Maybe he did.
Of course. Of course. So, I mean, just rounding off The Graduate then, for those who've never given it a go, what would you say to them all this time after the film's first landed?
I would have to say, like, it's actually a film that has kind of snuck up on me a little bit, and it wasn't necessarily in my own kind of purview for quite a long time. I saw it once when I was pretty young, like maybe sort of 18, 19.
Yeah.
And I saw it at a time when I was sort of, you know, hoovering up the films that Empire and Neon magazine and Select were telling me to watch. So I was trying to sort of, you know, be on the level with those films. And there were certainly some, like, I think at that time and at that age, maybe like Reservoir Dogs was probably resonating with me more than like A Graduate, which is, you know, a more sensitive and delicate film, I would say.
Well, also, lots of people heard of The Graduate just because of American Pie.
Well, indeed.
All these touch points over time.
So I'd heard of it through the joke from Wayne's World.
Well, is it the set? It's in the second one. Is it the first one or the second one?
It might be the
I think it's the second one. It might be.
Is it where he's with Cassandra, where he's like, Cassandra? Yeah, like, and then it's the wrong church. I probably would have seen that way before I saw the film. So again, yeah, you have all these sort of cultural touch points, which are sort of like corralling you towards this important artwork. But yeah, I maybe when I first saw it, I maybe was a little kind of archly dismissive, due to my age and you know, it's maybe for like personal reasons of not like necessarily getting it.
Yeah.
And, you know, revisiting it more recently, it was a film that I had real fun kind of grappling with.
Yeah.
I think there are elements of it that are very much of its era, in the you know, I think the way it's shot and edited and some of the kind of cultural, you know, some of the sort of cultural commentary about, you know, people and types and hotels and society at that time were a bit sort of, you know, were a very sort of their era. But I think that discussion of the sort of primal aspects of men and women and desire and what draws people to do that and the inherent drama in these kind of couplings and things that people, you know, unimaginable things that people will apparently do in the name of pleasure seeking, you know, it's certainly one that you want to sort of, you know, check in again with.
Hello darkness, my old friend, I've come to talk with you again.
The brand new collector's edition of The Graduate is available from the 15th of September on 4K Ultra HD Blu-ray. The new pack comes with 3 discs, a 64-page booklet, 2 posters, and the Simon and Garfunkel soundtrack CD as well. David, it's been a delight having you on this podcast. Before we let you go, we do have to ask you for a double bill from the Studio Canal collection. And unusually, I know you've sent it through to Queenie, the producer of this show, but I don't know what you've picked.
Okay. I think the first one I've picked is the John Schlesinger Far From the Madding Crowd,
okay.
1967, in homage to the great Terence Stamp, who recently passed. I've got to say, I'm not one for sort of mid-century literary costume drama adaptations.
Yeah.
But I love Judy Christie. I love Terence Stamp. I think the Nicholas Rogue cinematography in the film is extraordinary. He, you know, one of the things that he ended up being known for is shooting the color red.
Yeah.
And it comes through in all his films, and you can, kind of, you know, you very much get that in the way he shoots Stamp's kind of red tunic costume in this film, and the amazing kind of vistas he shoots. It's a beautifully shot film. And the other one is a bit of a change. It's the 1988 Vanishing by
Good
George
God.
Sluzier.
Right.
Which
okay.
is yeah, I mean that's purely because you know, seeing that film, it's so it, you know, to say it's memorable is something of an understatement.
Yeah.
You know, it does things and goes to places that quite few films
yeah.
manage. It's got one of the great shock endings, and in fact, you know what, I'm going to quote the great Mark Kermode, actually, his review of George Sluzier's American remake of the Vanishing,
which I watched first. I watched them in the wrong order.
Right, so you must watch the original 1988 Dutch version, not the American version. And Kermode's amazing review said, the Vanishing 1988 is about the banality of evil. The Vanishing 1993 is about the evil of banality.
Oh, lovely. Lovely. It is the 1988 is an absolute masterpiece of a film. A one-watch film. Because
yeah.
you don't actually need to watch it again.
Yeah, that's the thing.
It's just drilled into my head, that film.
Yeah, I'm thinking of it as a double bill for other people, not for me. I want other people to see it, but I would probably be like in the lobby or something.
David, that's our very first A Double Bill for Other People, Not for Me. Thank you so much for joining us on the Studio Canal Presents podcast.
No worries.
The brand new collector's edition of The Graduate is available from the 15th of September on 4K Ultra HD Blu-ray. It comes with three discs, a 64-page booklet, two posters and the Simon and Garfunkel soundtrack. We've just got time for some news from the world of Studio Canal, starting with a reminder about the incoming cinema release of I Swear. Now, I've seen this film twice now and it's a really special one, telling the real-life story of John Davidson, MBE. John Davidson has Tourette's and the film explores his life with it and attitudes towards it, as well as a whole bunch of other stuff in there too. And my guess is you're going to be hearing a lot more about it over the coming months. For now, it arrives in UK cinemas on the 10th of October 2025. Let's turn to home entertainment. We've talked about the 1945 Ealing film Dead of Night before on this show. It's a creepy collection of stories, one of which includes a really good novelty golf shot, all in an unmissable film. Now it's joining the Vintage Classics label with its 4K Ultra HD Blu-ray debut. The movie's been fully restored, comes with fresh extra features and a booklet, and it's due on the 20th of October 2025. The week before, you'll also be able to pick up Adrian Lyne's 1990 movie Jacob's Ladder, which is heading too to 4K disc for the first time. It's arriving in steelbook packaging on the 13th of October 2025 with a brand new restoration and a fresh documentary on the disc. It's up for pre-order right now. I'll be back soon with the next episode of Studio Canal Presents. Until the next time, to get all the news on Studio Canal films as it happens, and to find out more about the Apple TV and Prime Video channels, you can visit www.studiocanal.co.uk or follow Studio Canal at Studio Canal UK on X, Instagram and TikTok. Until the next time, ta-ta for now.